Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Let's hit it. Give me a vacation.
Vacation.
Give me a wave.
Surfing.
Give me a city tour.
The trolley.
Give me animals.
The zoo.
Give me some sea life. Give me museums.
Balboa Park.
Give me a woo.
Roller coaster.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your family vacation at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Pushkin. Around 1869, Dr. Emanuel Erman, a professor of economics in Vienna, wrote an article which explained that the time and effort involved in writing and mailing a letter was out of proportion to the size of the message sent. He thought there should be a more practical method for people to share shorter bits of correspondence. And unlike with most op-ed pieces, Dr. Erman's suggestions moved the needle. On October 1st of that year, the Austrian Post introduced the Correspondenzkarte. Forgive me, Frau Slosson, my 10th grade German teacher. The Correspondenzkarte was a rectangular card with space for an address on the front and a message on the back. Postage was printed right on the top right corner, and it cost half the price of a letter. Over time, the Correspondenzkarte and its descendants would become the platform of choice for four humble braggy words. Wish you were here. The postcard had arrived. I love the brevity of a postcard, how the form itself forces you to abandon formalities and cut quickly to your observations and impressions. And in the hands of an inspired writer, it can quickly transport the recipient to where it was written. And that's what happened to me when a couple weeks back, I received a message from my editor, Julia Barton, who was visiting Morocco.
Tangier sits in the lower jaw of the mouth that bites the Mediterranean off the Atlantic. I'd never been to North Africa before coming here. I'm basically chaperoning a trip of teenagers, led by my 19-year-old son, who travels the world now, but is not fully equipped for the realities of stomach bugs or airports without computers. I didn't really prepare for Morocco before we left, but fortunately, Tangier is a place that forgives ignorance. The city has been welcoming, or probably has been forced to welcome, outsiders forever, thanks to its lucrative geography. Just one example. On our way up a huge hill to get tea at the famous Café Haffa, overlooking the Straits of Gibraltar, we stumbled upon a necropolis. 3,000 years ago, the Phoenicians carved their tombs into the cliffs here. Those tombs are now just empty cavities filled with rainwater and trash, but it's still a romantic setting. You can imagine the Phoenicians winding up here as far as they could get from the center of their empire, and just lying down to rest. But the strangest place I stumbled upon was also the closest to our apartment in the old city, on a short alley called Rue d'Amérique. You get there through a gate called, at least on Google Maps, Bab Mirakan, the American gate. Try not to be distracted by the feral cats copulating on the stairs and head into the whitewashed maze of Tangier's Medina, the old city. After a couple of twists and turns, you'll find some guards dressed in universal guard casual, navy blue polyester slacks and sweaters with patches that say U.S. Mission to Morocco. They stand at the entrance to the only U.S. registered historic landmark in a foreign country, the Tangier American Legation. I'm fascinated by the official properties of the USA abroad. Our bristling consulates where cell phones are confiscated at security. The legation is no longer a consulate. That's now in the Moroccan capital, Rabat. Now this shard of America charges admission, the local equivalent of $5 to enter. And it houses a museum, a library, and cross-cultural scholarship. The legation building has been in America's hands for more than 200 years. So I paid my 50 dirham and found myself in the entryway of a tasteful villa with a fountain, reading a letter from George Washington to the Sultan of Morocco, December 1789. Turns out Morocco was the first nation to recognize the United States. Who knew? There's probably more to unpack about that story, but this museum does not really linger on it or the next two centuries. It's fast forward up the stairs to World War II. We learn all about how Tangier had become a den of spies in the interwar period. And then it turned out to be a great place for the Allies to orchestrate a land invasion of North Africa to keep it from falling into Hitler's hands. Operation Torch, as it was called, was a big success. Churchill, FDR, and ad hoc local informant Josephine Baker all feature in the story. And above a mannequin in a marine dress blue uniform, we see a traditional Moroccan knotted rug of the U.S. flag, offered in friendship after the war. Geopolitics now complete, you walk through multiple reception rooms with lots of strenuously upholstered furniture and plastic Christmas ornaments, down through a lovely courtyard to the Paul Bowles Wing. Paul Bowles was an American expat who lived in Tangier most of his life. His 1949 novel, The Sheltering Sky, generated a ton of romantic curiosity about Morocco. William S. Burroughs wrote Naked Lunch here. Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and Susan Sontag all came on pilgrimages. Bowles seemed to float above it all, writing and composing and hauling an Ampex reel-to-reel machine all over Morocco to record traditional music. I didn't know that much about him, but enough to know what the legation's exhibit leaves out. His fondness for hash and sex with Moroccan teenage boys, for instance. Here we just see artifacts of his creative life, his old typewriter and suitcases, book jackets and sheet music of his compositions, a sort of bohemian rhapsody. It's pretty surreal to go from George Washington to Paul Bowles in less than 10 minutes. Also very American feeling, because so much of every story is left out. Who is this museum for? Later on, I try to read up, irritated by the shallow globs of info I gleaned here. The Legation's Cultural Center does good work, such as free Arabic literacy classes for poor women. An American expat later tells me the Legation Villa is an awesome place for receptions and parties. But the museum doesn't really explain its own existence very well, or Tangier. There's almost nothing about the colonial era when Morocco was divided under European quote-unquote protection. And Tangier's situation was even more complicated as a neutral free trade zone from the 1920s to 1959. What were we Americans doing here, besides training spies and mapping Greenwich Village onto Tangier, as the Moroccan writer Hisham Aidi puts it? I know it's useless to expect cultural criticism from a property owned by the U.S. State Department. Legations do not do negation. I start to figure out who this place is for as I leave the front door and the guards, the cats now sleeping on the stairs, the seagulls squawking over the old Jewish cemetery, and the vendors hawking spices and fake hoodies. As we're sipping mint tea at Cafe Haffa, staring over the straits, it does become clear. The Tangier American Legation is for me. Not me, the visitor who would like more irony. I mean me, a citizen of the USA. This piece of 200-year-old real estate is a hedge. I read that Morocco is the largest purchaser of U.S. arms on the African continent. It's been hosting joint military exercises with us for nearly two decades. And when my government does something really unpleasant to the Arab-speaking world, as sometimes happens, at least we have the legation. We can host receptions in the presence of the knotted rug, Stars and Stripes, George Washington's vintage letter to the Sultan, and maybe even Paul Bowles' typewriter. Whatever might help us stay in good standing with our one old friend in the region. Our national historic site in Tangier sits at the edge of an empire, like those Phoenician tombs of old. Though I read that when Romans marched in and took over the city, they looted the tombs and removed all signs of Phoenicia. Turns out, Romans were not romantic at all.
A postcard from Tangiers, courtesy of my editor, Julia Barton. I've never been to Tangiers, but I have wanted to go ever since I read, yes, Paul Bowles' novel, The Sheltering Sky. And it was there that he made the observation, a difference between tourist and traveler is that a tourist accepts his own civilization without question, not so the traveler. And according to that framework, Julia is definitely a traveler. All right, we're going to take a break. When we get back, I speak with one of the most talented and cranky travel writers to ever do it.
We are here to accrue unredeemable air miles and tier points, to try to be upgraded on aeroplanes and in hotels wherever possible, to try to alter our itineraries to include Bora Bora, and to wish that the internet connections were faster and more reliable.
Writer Jeff Dyer joins me after the break. Plus, actor Coleman Domingo stops by to answer your travel questions. It's a real barn burner today, folks.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Do you have a digital mindset? Check out Season 3 of This Is Digital. Season 3 of This Is Digital goes behind the scenes to reveal how digital trends show up in everyday decisions and actions, including driving profitable growth in enterprise software and how the new sports fan experience can drive revenue. Featuring guests like Chris D'Agostino of Databricks and Scott Crable of Thoma Bravo. Check out the latest and greatest on Season 3 of This Is Digital and learn more at westmonroe.com.
Welcome back to Not Lost Chat, my series of conversations with fellow travelers. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. And, you know, one could argue that this whole chat series was an elaborate excuse for me to speak with one of my favorite travel writers, Jeff Dyer. Now, to clarify, Dyer isn't simply a travel writer. He's won numerous awards for his books about jazz, photography, and film. He's also written four novels, including The Color of Memory and Jeff in Venice. His latest work is called The Last Days of Roger Federer, another subject dear to my heart. In that work, Jeff confronts his own middle age by examining the last days and plays of famous athletes, writers, and artists. But I'm not alone in thinking that it's in his travel writing where he really shines. And you can find it in collections like Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It and White Sands. So when I met with him, I asked him to start by reading me a passage from White Sands. And at this point in the book, Jeff is on the island of Iwo-Owa, nearing the end of his visit to French Polynesia.
I joined some other tourists for a boat trip to a nearby island. The minivan taking us to the boat was late, but this didn't matter because when we got to the port, the boat was not ready to sail. That was the thing about Iwo-Owa. The huge weight to leave contained within it other little pockets of waiting, so that one was caught in an endless hierarchy of waiting. I was always waiting for the next bit of waiting, climaxing with the final day's waiting in which I would wait to be transferred to the airport, where I would wait for the plane taking me back to Tahiti before the wait for the enormous airborne weight of the flight back to LA, more waiting, and on to London itself. In a sense, that is what we're here for, to wait. While waiting, however, one necessarily ponders other questions, questions that don't go away, irrespective of how long one waits. Where did I come from? Where am I going? How long have I got? But the answers to those big questions turn out to be small, or at least they have to be itemized in detail if they're to have any chance of doing justice to the big questions. We are here to accrue unredeemable air miles and tier points, to try to be upgraded on aeroplanes and in hotels wherever possible, to try to alter our itineraries to include Bora Bora, and to wish that the internet connections were faster and more reliable. We are here to suffer terrible disorientation and jet lag, and to be plagued constantly by the desire to be somewhere else. Either somewhere else in French Polynesia, or ideally somewhere else altogether, preferably nearer home. We are here to wish we'd brought different books to read and to wonder what happened to our lost biography of Gauguin. We are here to wish the food was better and not to be afflicted by the torment of heat rash and to wish that we'd brought some calamine lotion to lessen that torment. We are here to buy presents for our loved ones and then to spend long hours constructing excuses as to why this was impossible because everything in Tahiti is so expensive and there's nothing worth buying anyway. We are here to be bored rigid and then to wonder how it was possible to be so bored. We are here to wait at Iwo-Owa Airport in the drenching humidity and to feel definitively what we have felt before, albeit only fleetingly. That we are glad we came, even though we spent so much of our time wishing we hadn't. We are here to make sure our seat belts are securely fastened, our tray tables stowed, and our seats are in the upright position before takeoff and landing. We are here to go somewhere else.
Thank you for that. I feel like this essay, I think on the one hand is like later era Jeff Dyer traveling, but it also encapsulates a lot of what you do, which is you take us on this trip with you, you talk about the joys and the struggles, you talk about the agony, and yet this permanent desire to go on. And I wondered if you could talk about how you gave yourself permission to be open about those things and how that's played out.
I have this idea, really, it's almost like a contract, that I feel that nobody should come out of anything I write looking worse than me, really. So I feel that typically the object of the satire in my book is myself. But certainly one wants to articulate the fact that, you know, there's no point shying away from the fact that a lot of the time places are disappointing. and, you know, the food is bad and all that kind of stuff. But what is terrible, I think, is if you go with that as a predetermined setting to sort of take things down, because what you don't want to do is have that kind of that satirical dimension. You don't want that to render you incapable of responding to the wonder of the world.
Well, something that does appear in your books, even for a reader not doing some literary analysis, I think was captured by James Wood, who wrote you up in The New Yorker a few years back. And he described your method, or how he has perceived your method, as, quote, a loitering investigation, somehow intense and slackerish. The author not quite pursuing his subject, but hanging around it like a clever, aimless boy on a street corner. I don't know about the clever, aimless boy part, but I do think the idea of loitering is interesting. In a lot of your works, some of fiction, some nonfiction, the character, you, go to a place, post up, and just you're kind of present. And you're not there for some big adventure. You're there just to be present. And I wonder if you could speak to that mode and talk about how your approach used to be about covering a place.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of what I was doing. One of the reasons that I've remained interested in traveling is because we never went anywhere when I was a kid. You know, I didn't get on a plane until I was 22. And my parents, both of whom are dead now, they died without ever having been on a plane. My pre-adult life was so unadventurous. And then I gradually got into going to places. But I think because I wasn't used to it, I didn't like it, because I missed all the conveniences of home and all this kind of stuff. And then I hit upon, it's a bit later, this way of traveling in a way that suited me, which was to go somewhere and then stay for a little length of time, so that I wasn't just moving around all the time, which is, of course, famously tiring. And then if I rented a place, as I did in New Orleans, I could have my little routine, I could have my kettle and all this kind of stuff, do some work in the day, which I liked. So on the one hand, I had all the excitement and thrills and attentiveness, that's important, of being in a new place. But I had all the security of being able to lead my normal sort of routine life. And that really suited me. And that meant that I was, as you said, there, you know, without any kind of purpose.
So that was your mode of travel for a while. And, you know, it's particularly apparent in your collection, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered. Now you continue to do travel writing. Your collection before your most recent book, White Sands, was mostly a compendium of travel writing. And now you're married. You seem to live a relatively happy, stable life in Los Angeles. And yet you continue to do this. So why do you keep at it? Why do you keep traveling?
And I guess my answer to why I kept at it is I think I've quoted before that wonderful line of Annie Dillard's where she says, you know, it's a very interesting planet. We're only here for a short time, so we might as well get a feel for the place. I mean, it's an utterly stupendous place, so it seems crazy not to have been everywhere that you can go to at least once. And certainly there are plenty of places that you only want to go to once, and there are plenty of places actually that, having been to once, you think, oh, that really wasn't worth going to.
You know, there's a passage in one of your pieces, and I've been rereading all of them and listening to the audiobooks, so they're all a jumble in my mind. But you're in North London, and you walk by where you think Julian Barnes's house is, another British writer. And you say, you know, I'm sure I'm near Julian Barnes, who writes every day in his desk at his home. And essentially what you're saying is, like, how can you possibly be a writer and just be sitting at a desk at a home in northern London from 9 to 5, 5 days a week? And so I guess the question is, which came first for you? Is it the urge to travel and writing kind of helped fuel that? Or you wanted to be this writer? And so your responsibility then was to really take in as much of the world as you can in this romantic sense.
Yeah, this is a really good question and a really good distinction you raise. So, I mean, I guess the first thing I should say is that that was just a little sort of joke of a paradox that I came up with. And I, I do believe absolutely, along with, I can't remember who said it now. It might have been Camus or somebody else who said that it's possible to lead a life of great adventure without leaving your desk. So there's that. For me, I found that by the time my first novel had come out, called The Colour of Memory, set in this one area of London, Brixton, in South London, I didn't really have much that I wanted to say about Britain after that. And from that point on, the two things went hand in hand in that, yeah, I really wanted to see the world. And I found also that by seeing the world, I would have more to write about. So the pattern that got repeated quite often is that I'd arrange to write some sort of article about a place. And that was nice because it killed several birds with one stone. I got paid, the accommodation was covered, all this kind of stuff. But then typically, what would happen is I'd write the piece about the place, and then I'd find that actually the place was far more interesting than I could say in so many words. And so a larger book would come about. So, you know, for example, my wife and I were very keen to go to Varanasi, Benares, in India. So I arranged to write an article for a British paper. And almost as soon as I got there, I realized that this little novel I was writing about Venice, set during the Venice Biennale, almost as soon as we arrived at the ghats on the banks of the Ganges in Varanasi, I knew that that book would have to be expanded. And there'd be a second part set in Varanasi, in this epicenter of Hinduism. And so out of an assignment, a straightforward travel writing assignment, very quickly that experience led to something which was going to be incorporated into a work of fiction. I mean, it's fantastic to be in Varanasi, but it was even more wonderful to go there for me, knowing that I was writing about it, because it made me especially attentive to what was going on. So I was there with my antennae out, noticing things that I might not otherwise have done, but also trying to arrive at a way of understanding the place, which is, in many ways, it's incomprehensibly strange. I mean, it's just so far out.
And the novel that resulted from that trip, Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, it reads like both a travelogue and a novel, a story of discovery. It's also quite spicy in places. There's lots of sex, drugs, and Prosecco. And most of your writing has a lot of those elements, not always Prosecco. And it made me wonder, what does your family make of your writing?
You know, as one gets older, one reflects on one's life. And one of the great privileges, I think, of my life is that I came from a family of non-readers. And what that means is that when I sort of discovered this thing of reading, it was a total revelation. And then the other thing, I feel so lucky that my parents, although they read some of my articles, I don't think they ever read any of my books. And so when I was writing, say, Paris Trance or Jeff in Venice or any of them, really, it was a real sense of liberation that I wasn't having my mum looking over my shoulder when I was writing that stuff. That was a real sense of liberation.
This all reminds me of something the comedian Pete Holmes once said about how it feels odd bringing your partner home for the first time to meet your parents, because you're basically saying, Mom, Dad, here's what I'm into. This big reveal of your private life. Fortunately, my parents don't listen to my podcast. All right, I want to step back for a second. You have traveled from Tahiti to Venice to New Orleans and everywhere in between. What is a lesson that you can pass along to other folks? What has traveling taught you?
It seems to me one of the lessons of travel, and it's a very, very simple one, but it's a profound one too. I mean, we're all aware of the incredible inequality of wealth in the world. I was staying one time at the Four Seasons in, I think it was Bombay, and it's one of the quirks of where the Four Seasons is, this splendid hotel, that right outside it, there's this sprawling slum. And you know, it really is the case that as you walk around, you're aware that, oh, actually, I've got more value in my hotel safe than these people will probably have in their lives. So given that terrible inequality, it's amazing, really, that you don't get robbed all the time. And of course, you don't want to, you don't want to behave stupidly and recklessly. But generally speaking, isn't it amazing how little we have to fear from other people? That generally, most people are no more thinking of harming us than we would then.
You said once the lesson of travel seems to be so banal but so great, which is that people are just so amazingly decent the world over. Which I've also, you know, that's the nature of my show is kind of going into these towns and you kind of want to get invited back to someone's home for dinner to see how they really live. And it's incredible how often one succeeded, but it is definitely one of the most powerful parts of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's all true. Although, I mean, I'm so keen to not be a sentimentalist.
So while preparing for this chat, I came across a video online of you and the writer Sam Lipsight, the lovely and very funny human being that is Sam. You two are talking, and you start talking about Jack Kerouac. And Sam was saying that he hadn't read him since high school, and you were saying that you still read him. And honestly, I was a little bit heartened by your response, although I haven't read him recently. My primary time with him was spent in high school, but I don't think I've ever really recovered. You know, I think the ripples from his writing continue to emanate in my life. So I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about your relationship with this patron saint of road trips in America.
Yeah, I mean, my experience was similar to yours. And I think I first read him unsuccessfully when I was young. It was that time at school, you know, when the teachers are all trying really hard to persuade you that literature is not old and boring. But when they first asked us to read On the Road, they went too far the other way. It was too cool. So I just didn't get it. And then I think I successfully read it a few years later, let's say when I was 19 or 20. And of course, I loved it. I've ended up rereading On the Road every 5 years. And for me, it just gets better and better. I've never grown out of it. I mean, the book changes as you become more familiar with it. It just seems to become increasingly moving and wonderful.
What about it still grabs you? Is it the writing itself, the energy, or his role in America, in the history of writing?
Well, I suppose I could give you a one-word answer to your question, what is it about On the Road? And I would say it's the everything about it. But I guess I should emphasize two things. One, obviously, as soon as you have an actual physical journey, then you have automatic and inherent narrative interest. You start somewhere and you end up somewhere else, and you start on page one and you end up on page whatever it is. I think that's a crucial thing, this combination of geographical movement and our movement through the pages. So there's that. I think stylistically, it's really, I mean, the energy of the prose, and crucially, it's lyricism. It seems to me Kerouac is a gorgeously lyrical writer, and of course, there's a kind of lyrical excess in it, but it seems to me a condition of youth in a way is that you're not able to ration the lyricism. But the abiding thing, which gets stronger as you age, it's such a wonderful novel about friendship and loss. And in particular, you know, there's the famous Dean Moriarty, Neil Cassady character, and the sort of poignance of the sense of him being sort of left behind, stranded. I mean, that really is one of the enduring things about the book.
That's funny. I don't think of the sadness around Neil. I just think of their kind of bonhomie and joy. So maybe I'll have to revisit it soon once I'm done reading your latest. Jeff, thank you so much for coming to chat with me. I really appreciated this conversation.
Thank you, Brendan. It's been a great pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks a lot.
All right. Once again, that was Jeff Dyer. His latest book is called The Last Days of Roger Federer. And in it,
He discusses, along with other luminaries, the aforementioned Jack Kerouac. So check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when I get back, I'll be talking to actor, writer, and director Coleman Domingo, who will be here to help answer some of your travel questions.
I think it's actually a crime for children to sit in business class or first class.
Do not at me. At him, not me. Not lost. We'll be right back.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Digital trends show up every day in business decisions and actions. West Monroe is the number one strategic partner translating technology into financial value for companies. The This Is Digital podcast applies West Monroe's two decades of secrets and best practices to your business's benefit. Favorite past topics from the last three seasons include how AI and the next generation of employees are shaping the workplace, becoming a product company, Highmark's journey, and what does it mean to put the customer first? Learn more at westmonroe.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We've been on a journey this episode from Tangier to French Polynesia to Varanasi, and now we're about to go to Los Angeles, where the actor Coleman Domingo is going to help me answer your travel questions. Now, his face might not immediately pop to your mind, but you've certainly seen him. He is a writer, director, and actor who is best known for his roles in Zola, Candyman, and most recently, he won an Emmy for his performance in Euphoria, in which he plays Ali, the Narcotics Anonymous sponsor of Zendaya's character. Here's a clip.
You think you're hard? I'm harder. You think you're tough? I'm tougher. You got clean and want to kill yourself? Same motherfucking story here. You want to know why? You want to know why? I'll tell you why. Because you don't know how to live life. You don't have the tools. You're too busy running around trying to bullshit everybody into thinking you're hard and you don't give a fuck when in reality you give so much of a fuck you can't even bear to be alive. So guess what? New rule. No more wasting my motherfucking time. You want to use, use, but the least you can do is be honest. Own that shit.
Yeah, it is not a rom-com. In addition to Euphoria, last year Coleman released an animated short film called New Moon, which was a tribute to his mother and a love letter to all black mothers and sons. And he recently wrapped production on The Color Purple, the newest film adaptation of Alice Walker's book, where he plays the abusive and terrifying husband, Mister. So yeah, he does all sorts of roles. When I spoke with Coleman, I asked him how he keeps his head straight while bouncing between such intense and different roles.
It's wild. You got to find ways to have light in your life. And I think that I've been gifted, and I'll just say gifted because it's a huge responsibility, roles like Mister and Rustin pretty much in the same calendar year. And they're like heavy duty, heavy lifting work. And I now have a practice of making sure that I do things like something physical, like I'll go for a run. I become a runner, basically. I'll do things to make sure I take care of myself on days off, like I buy myself flowers. I eat really well. I go to amazing restaurants wherever I am. And I had to tell my business manager that. He was like, well, you know, your spending has gone up a little while you're in production. I'm like, yeah, because it's called self-care. Because I have to really, I have to eat well. I have to nourish my body and my mind and atmosphere. Yeah. I have to do all of those things. So that's all a part of the work as well that I realized, that it can't just be about the work. Because if it's just that, I think you may go a little nuts in a way if you're just in that dark space all the time.
Like if you're going to go this far on one side, you need something to bring on the other.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I never thought about that, how like, yeah, you're playing a villain all day. And then, yes, it, like maybe I do need to take a bath and have a nice dinner just to remind myself that I'm Coleman, not
that I'm human.
Creep.
Yeah. That's exactly it. You have to remind yourself who you are, actually. Like, I stay in it. When I'm in it, I'm in it.
Yeah.
But I still must come home and take care of this human being that I am.
Yeah. Do you still have the show Bottomless Brunch at Coleman's?
Bottomless Brunch at Coleman's? We finished our fourth season.
Okay.
And we're transitioning to another show, which is sort of a takeoff of Bottomless Brunch.
I'm happy to hear that, actually, Coleman. Because I wrote a book called Brunch is Hell. I've been pretty anti-brunch. For a lot of my...
You're anti-brunch? Why? You hate brunch? Who hates brunch? I actually said to people, no one hates brunch. That's why I had a brunch show. I mean, no one says, oh, I hate going to brunch. You hate going to brunch?
I hate going to brunch. I think it...
What? Why?
I think it's... You have many people. They work Monday through Friday. Maybe it's the Philly in me. You have 2 days off a week. You're going to stab one of those days in the heart with a mimosa at 2 p.m. I feel like...
You don't want to chill? You don't want to have like fun day Sunday? Yeah, so what do you do instead of go to brunch? Will you sit mad? What are you doing?
I mean, sometimes I do sit mad, but sometimes I work on creative projects for myself. I cook breakfast at home.
No,
you're not,
sir,
buying.
No, I'm not buying it. What you have to do, that's still doing creative work. You're still doing creative work.
Okay.
You should be doing things like nothing.
Okay.
That's what brunch is for.
Okay.
To eat and drink and talk.
Yeah. All right. That gives me anxiety to do nothing. So.
Really? Yeah,
but I like that you're calling me out.
You're not wired.
I just feel like I got errands to do. I got things.
Why do you think you still have a lot? This is. I'm turning the tables on you. Do you realize that?
Yeah.
Why do you feel that you have? And now I'm your therapist too. Yeah. Like, why do you always feel like you have something to do?
I don't know. I feel like maybe I feel those hours of by myself. Like not. I guess at work sometimes I feel anxious. And when I just have time to myself, I'm less anxious. And then I feel like then I need to take advantage of those moments. And productivity. And it's a bit of a curse. Maybe it's I got the flu called capitalism.
Dude, I think you might need brunch in your life. You could use a good brunch.
All right,
brunch.
Well, if I come through, because you own a bar, is that right, in L.A.? The Wolves?
Yeah, I'm a co-owner of the Wolves. I'm a co-owner of a bar in downtown L.A., and it's a good place to go to brunch and chill.
Well, maybe if I'm in L.A.
If you're in L.A. and you can't bring anything with you, I don't want to look over and be like, what creative project are you doing over there?
All right, I'll just show up and we'll do it. So
really?
You enjoy travel. Do you have any broad travel wisdom to share? Like when you're going places for pleasure, do you have any guidelines?
Well, it's funny. I do actually. Let me just tell you about my 50th birthday travel plans.
Okay.
This will explain everything. For my 50th birthday, I knew I wanted to spend 3 weeks in Europe.
Mm.
Where? I don't know. But I did book my flights in and out of London. Mm. And then it was about once I'm there, I will go where the weather takes me or where I feel like going. So I would go from London to Paris, and then I went to Berlin. I wanted to go somewhere that I'd never been. And I was like, is it Prague or is it Vienna?
Hmm.
And we looked at Vienna and we're like, let's go to Vienna. I don't know anything about Vienna.
Yeah.
Maybe the sausages or Mozart.
Yeah.
So we booked the flight, got to Vienna, got a hotel, and then was like, we're here. What is this place?
Yeah.
And then we found incredible museums and walks and restaurants and everything and just went down a rabbit hole. That's what I love to do. If I'm going to a major city, I'll try to find like, it sounds very bougie, but I'll try to find like a store like Gucci
or something. Right. Okay.
So then I know that I'm in a decent area. If I want a 5-star hotel, I'll find it near there.
Yeah, fair enough.
If I want more of a 4-star artistic, like if I go to Mexico City, I'm like, I think I want to be in the alt. So I will look up hipster coffee shops or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So, great. Yeah. That puts me in Roma. I'm going to be in Roma then. Great. So I'll get the hotel there and I'm like, this is the neighborhood I need to be in.
I love it.
Depending on the experience.
Yeah.
So I just put myself in a place and then figure it out.
So you're like a flaneur who would just stroll around cities, but you're like that... and maybe with a larger area to roam, you're like, I'll put myself in a place and then I'm going to go where my instincts tell me to go and just relax.
Yeah,
I support that.
Absolutely. And I support that. And I feel like I'm very like, you know, I'm very easy about what it has to be. I think when you have almost low or no expectations of what the city's going to offer, everything is a treat because you take the city as it is, you know?
I do. All right, Coleman, despite your blind spot about brunch, you strike me as a wise man. Are you ready to help my audience with their travel etiquette questions?
Sure.
All right, this first one comes from Nicole from Chicago. And Nicole writes, recently I went on a trip with some old college friends. We went to Nashville for a girls' weekend. On the first night, we ordered the tasting menu at a Michelin-starred restaurant. And one of my friends, who has gotten increasingly fussy as she's gotten older, felt ill after our appetizers. So we ended the dinner early and returned to the hotel. So her friend was like not feeling great, kind of short-circuited their Michelin dinner. Ultimately, she was fine. The next night, we went out to see live music, and after one round of drinks, she announced she wanted to leave. I offered to get her an Uber, and she was offended that we weren't all ready to leave with her. What was the right thing to, when you're making a motion?
Get her to fuck off that trip.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Old friend.
Yeah.
Old friend, she's changed the way. She's not like she used to be anymore. She needs to be in bed at 9, and she needs her little meal, whatever makes her feel good.
Yeah.
She wasn't meant to go on this trip. She should have known. She should have pulled back. I'm like, yo, you get in the Uber. You're not going to ruin this for everybody. And yo, we're going to a Michelin-style restaurant. We're going. You got to be a little cutthroat about stuff like that. You're like, no, you can't handle it. Sorry.
No, that's fair. I think like you look him in the eye one time, you're like, this is your call. And then after that, we're all adults.
Her friend was going to have a problem no matter what.
Sounds like it.
Day one, you should have known. When she got sick off the appetizers, no bueno.
Coleman, I agree with him. No,
we got
no
you.
Guilt.
We got
no
you,
guilt.
Nicole.
Okay, this next question comes from Dan from Michigan. Dan asks, am I obligated to sit next to someone's pet on the airplane? I think like there might be rules and regulations, but I guess the question is, how do you feel about pets on airplanes and people's politics around them?
Well, I feel like you should get, I feel like you should get an alert or something to let you know if you're okay with it. And would you want to move or something?
Yeah.
I feel like it should be known if you bought a dog, if you have a dog or a cat, because you could be allergic to it.
I mean, I am allergic to dogs and cats, but I think that's a good thought. Like, I think in the past 5 to 10 years, we've seen pets enter places they never were entering before. Like, I feel like they just are more restaurants, more cafes. And generally, I'm okay with that. Pets make people happy. But as someone who has allergies, especially on a long flight, sometimes that's the biggest budget purchase of the year is a plane ticket. And to sit next to a cat, I think a little bit of now we're at the front. We've been doing this long enough. We need to have some rules and regulations. So
I think so, too. Now, which brings me to something that has nothing to do with this, but something to do with this. I think it's actually a crime for children to sit in business class or first class.
Okay. All right.
Why? Because, kid, what kind of business do you have?
Yeah.
And then there was a baby crying in business class. I'm like, these seats cost a lot of money. And your baby's crying. Oh. I sound like a horrible person, don't I?
But
I'm like,
direct your emails and tweets to Coleman Domingo. This is not my first rodeo, Coleman. I can't go on record. I can't go on record supporting that. All right. So going on to our next question. Here we go. This is from Jacob from Los Angeles. He asks, for Americans abroad, is it better to attempt speaking a few words of the local language poorly?
Yes.
Or just sheepishly start your conversations in English?
You should always try.
Okay.
You should always try.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you look like a dumb American.
Okay.
Don't do that to us.
And
there's enough of us out there already as dumb Americans. Don't be another one.
I think what I like about the question too is like, should I try poorly? That at least indicates that you read up on it or you're trying. Like that's the effort is huge.
And they'll appreciate that you're like, oh, you came here and you want to speak our language. How nice.
Yeah.
You sound abysmal, but I'm with you.
All right, one last question. I think you answered this when you were talking about your travel habits, but I'll ask it. This is from Grant from North Carolina. When I travel somewhere, I often stick to the tourist spots or the top destinations a place has to offer. I want to do more off the beaten path exploring, but I don't know where to start. Any tips?
Neighborhoods.
Okay.
Think about the people who live there and start walking more than anything. Mm. When I go to any city, I will just start walking and walk to where you feel safe and get a little lost. Mm. It's okay. These days you've got you can get an Uber, you can call a cab, something. But people are actually, I think people out in the world, when you travel and know you're foreign, I feel like people have always been friendly to me. And like, if you're friendly, if you're open, just saying you need help. I've gone to, I remember when I went to Marrakesh, and I felt like my brain turned inside out because I didn't understand anything. The roads, the way cars went, the way the streets were crowded, you name it. But I feel like I know that people, if I got lost, like in the souks, I would just go to someone who seemed warm and friendly and ask them. I also believe that like what you put out is also what you get back. I believe that I'm protected and safe in the world. Mm. And I think that that's exactly what resonates for me. And so I will take myself into a neighborhood that I don't know and ask a local, where can you get a good meal around here? And people feel pride. They want to go down there. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
My mother's family's Croatian, and they have a phrase, God protects drunks and idiots. And I feel like when you're a traveler, you're a bit of an idiot. And they're...
Like, are you calling me a drunk and an idiot? Is that what you're calling me?
Not yet.
Is this the way we're going to end this? Is this the way we're going to end this podcast?
Not yet. Wow, I was projecting. I'm sorry.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
This really took a
turn. Oh, I thought this was my therapy appointment. I'm sorry. It's my interview with Coleman.
This totally took a turn.
No, but you know, when you're traveling, you're a bit of a dingbat, and I think that there maybe, you know, there could be an aura around you that people will often help you. All right. Well, look, Coleman, thank you so much for your travel tips. Congratulations on all the great stuff you're cooking up. And
thank you.
You're such a pleasure to chat with. Thank you for coming by.
This is fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Once again, that was Coleman Domingo, everybody. Be on the lookout because he has two new films coming out later this year, Rustin and The Color Purple. And that concludes our journey this episode of Not Lost Chat. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have travel questions, as always, you can email them to me at notlost@pushkin.fm, and I'll try to get them in front of one of our future guests. Or you can ping me at bfnunum on Twitter. Pinging, is that what that's called? Sounds better than DMing. Not Lost Chat was produced by Jordan Bailey, who, true to form, will be taking a little road trip soon to Asheville. So if you're down there, please roll out the welcome mat for her. This show is written and hosted by me, Brendan Francis Noonan. We received booking assistance from the wonderful Laura Morgan. This episode was edited by Julia Barton, who also contributed that fantastic postcard at the top. Way to outshine your host, Julia. I've got some work ahead of me for that next postcard. Our managing producer is Jacob Smith, and our mix engineer and co-producer is the wonderful Sarah Bruguere. Not Lost is a co-production of Pushkin Industries, Topic Studios, and iHeartMedia. It was developed at Topic Studios. Executive producers include me, Brendan Francis Noonan, Christy Gressman, Maria Zuckerman, Lisa Langang, and Latal Malad. If you dig what you hear, please tell a friend, go talk to Apple Podcasts, spread the word. It's all really appreciated. You can sign up for the Pushkin newsletter and find out everything happening over here at pushkin.fm/newsletter. And if you'd like to find some more Pushkin podcasts, great stuff happening now, great stuff on its way, new season of Deep Cover, you can listen and find them on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. That is it for this episode. Thanks, everybody. Bon voyage.
Did you catch season 3 of This Is Digital? Season 3 of This Is Digital goes behind the scenes to reveal how digital trends show up in everyday decisions and actions, including digital lessons from the EV revolution and the chief digital officer's role in disruption and culture. Featuring guests like Ekta Chopra of Elf Beauty and Tyson Jomini of JD Power. Do you have a digital mindset? Find out by checking out the latest and greatest on season 3 of This Is Digital and learn more at westmonroe.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.